The Australian Articles, Chapter 22, Sydney, City of Dizzy Heights. The Sydney Harbour Bridge is synonymous with Australia and New Year. A symbol of some stature, it is a charismatic icon in Australia, and of course, there were so many here that we'd been fortunate to see, the Great Barrier Reef and Uluru among them. Sydney was the last tourist destination of our very best of Australia trip, and one distant journey's recognised in their planning. Our hotel for this part of the visit affording a stunning panoramic view of the harbour and bridge from every single room. In 1932, the bridge was completed, the vision of John Bradfield, chief engineer with the Department of Public Works. There is little doubt that Bradfield was a genius. Completing first a bachelor degree and later a first-class master's degree, he achieved the university medal at both universities. He first conceived of the idea some 17 years earlier, proposing three significant projects for the city. The north and south shores might be linked by a bridge, electrifying the railways, and improving the underground service. World War I put these grand but visionary schemes on hold. His thesis on the Sydney Harbour Bridge earned him a Doctorate of Science in 1924, and so it was that the proposal became a reality. The bridge was completed at a time when there were very few cars on the road, but his vision of a six-vehicular lane, two tram lanes and two railway lines, a pedestrian and cycle path, still remains sufficient to deal with the 56 million vehicles a year that cross it. For whatever reason, the tram lines did not materialise, but the space was assigned to the vehicular lanes, providing four lanes in either direction when crossing the bridge. A toll still exists despite the bridge being paid off in 1988, but upkeep costs are high given this is a steel structure and maintenance is an ongoing matter. The bridge is the sixth longest arch bridge in the world with a span of 504 metres. Constructed in steel, manufactured in Middlesbrough, England by Dorman Long, they leveraged some of the Tyne bridge design into their contract. During the hot weather, the bridge expands about 18 centimetres, but this was appreciated in the design and hinges afford the expansion with little interference in the function it performs for the traffic that cross it daily. At its pinnacle, the bridge is 134 metres above water level, and we were going to experience this directly during our trip to Sydney with the bridge climb. Many years ago, the Lion's youngest sister visited Australia and was proposed to under this bridge. For our visit, this wasn't an option, so we were planning to climb the famous icon instead, and we paid nearly $650 to do so. It is not cheap, but if you can save the money or earn a little bit extra as you travel, it is a very worthwhile experience. That is, if heights don't scare the shit out of you. Six of our trip colleagues were taking part in the climb with us, making the trip even more significant since we were doing it with friends. The Horse Whisperer and Hyena, having missed out on the scuba dive, signed up. The Swan and the Peacock from the south coast of England, the Rabbit and the Sea Lion from Barnsley, all joined us, adding a celebratory and camaraderie feeling to the event. You need about 3.5 hours for the trip, and we were booked on to the 4 p.m. climb and didn't actually get anywhere near the bridge until 5. Our first task was to complete a health and fitness questionnaire sitting in a circular room. We completed the forms in silent, an industrious little circle, scribbling away and hoping we made it through the first hurdle without too many dropouts. There were another four younger people on our climb, and they must have wondered how they ended up with the Saga tour on this particular climb, or whether some of us would even make it. Ha! Not so in this group of oldies. We passed the first test with flying colours. Ben, our guide, led us collectively into our second circle of the day. Standing this time, we were asked to say where we were from and why we were climbing the bridge. Our youngsters were from Peru, Denmark and England, but whether we were young or old, Every male in the group admitted they were only doing it because the women in their lives wanted to. How interesting that the women, universally, were the drivers for this particular climb. Having introduced ourselves to the team and passed the second test, we were now handed our suits, the first part of equipment we needed for the climb. The suit itself has gone through several iterations before reaching the current design, a grey onesie with blue flashes on the arms and legs that zips up the back. You're assigned a locker and asked to leave everything that might fall from your person in the locker before you begin your ascent. Such is the importance of this request, you will also undergo a metal detector frisk once you've gotten the suit on. There can be no chance of causing a major incident from a falling phone or watch once you're up that high. The suit equalised everyone, now all the same aside from age. The first demonstrable sign of becoming a team has been delivered. Once we were suitably attired, we moved into a much wider room which was kitted out with individual stations with belts and braces, a radio room and two sets of stairs linked by a platform. Our leader now emerged, taking over from the delectable Ben, clearly on a higher pay grade and not to be troubled by the menial but important tasks such as allocating the right size suit to the party. G, as our guide liked to be called, was an experienced operator. He provided you with a confidence from the outset and took time to recall every single one of our names as he talked us through our paces. Our first task was to be shown to an individual station. Direct leadership was required here as we were tasked to stand with our hands on the bars and await further instruction. Once everyone was in place, we were instructed to step into the braces and secure the belted clips. Collectively, we put our legs into the braces, silently following the instructions that were designed to eliminate confusion as each of us got into the gear. Having checked everyone's clips were properly in place, we were now directed to the front of the steps and platforms, who would learn the techniques on how to climb the steep steps of the bridge in a practice run. G demonstrated how a cord with an open-ended clip could attach us safely during the climb to the fixed structures of the bridge. It slid on at the start of the climb, gliding along a continuous linear steel rail that sat just below the handrail. There were intermittent breakpoints in this rail, but they could only be opened with a key by guides to allow them to navigate up and down the group as we progressed. The clip afforded you a continuous link to safety throughout the climb. Once the entire group had learned to navigate the steep steps up and down, recognising the importance of keeping the clip on the right side of the body as you turn to descend backwards and not getting into a fankle. We watched and listened attentively. Such was the importance of the information we needed to keep safe on the climb. At this point, a group returning from their climb entered the room, buzzing with excitement. One of the youngsters in our group wished we could get started, almost 40 minutes of preparation having taken place so far. Once we'd all mastered the trial climb, we were moved out to the comms room. We lined up facing each other as a radio was clipped to our suit braces with a set of headphones linking us with the instructor as we navigated the bridge. One or two had to change headsets as a full and comprehensive check whether we could hear the guide took place. But once we were all connected and spectacles and hats were attached by strings to loops on the braces, we had a final brief from G before we headed along the grey-painted corridors towards a door that would lead us onto the bridge. We waited, anticipating what lay ahead in a holding bay, the heat building in the suits. I was glad to have shorts and a t-shirt only underneath. We were offered a hat but opted to leave this for the collection once we'd completed the climb. After all, I couldn't have my hair messed up for the photographs now, could I? Once outside, we were immediately clipped to the rail, walking along the narrow mesh walkway that gave you a waffle-eye view of the ground below. Looking down is essential just to see the progress you're making, in height terms. Looking out just as important as the panoramic views alter as you ascend, and looking up just gives you time to pray to God you don't fall. Once clipped on, we quickly began moving along the grid at pace, the guide constantly checking we were maintaining it. It was clear the climb was not considered by Bradfield during his design. Most of the steps and rails were added by the climbing company, but the walkways with low pipes and occasional platforms leading to electric stations reminded you these conditions were what workers had to endure every day just to ensure the safety and efficiency of the bridge. Our first photograph enabled the other iconic site of Sydney to take centre stage. The Sydney Opera House was slid into the background. Just before we stopped for our picture, two pipes either side of your head sprayed water in a mist to cool you down. A thoughtful addition on this beautiful autumn day. The sky was without cloud, the temperature was not too hot, and the view is spectacular to the east, west, north and south of the city. We had time to peruse these at leisure as we were each allowed two poses for the first picture stop. Once taken, G led us up to the summit. The pace continued as we made the climb, trying to remember to look down, up and out, as we also tried to keep our balance on the slim but adequate steps. As we reached the pinnacle, our panoramic view now included new bays, previously concealed behind hills as our ascent took us higher. We were directed by G to count how many cars passed between red cars on the bridge below. Suitably tasked, we all watched the cars. Now the height of rush hour crisscrossed the four lines assigned from the south to the north side with some purpose. It was noisy, bikes, buses, trucks and cars whizzing along as we tried to count past the best target of 30 before the occasional red car brought us back to zero and we started to count all over again. This activity allowed each pair to make a short video as we stood atop of the bridge. The line was not a fan of this, so we opted for pictures only, and once we were all through the photo station at the summit, it was time for the descent. The descent was aided by individual guides waiting at the steep steps to ensure you managed the turn without a fankle, and to let the individual before you clear the stairs before you began. These guides engaged you in small talk, taking your mind off the task and cleverly relaxing you into this trickier aspect of the climb. We arrived back in the holding bay exhilarated. I'm sure if you've read any theories of well-being, I would place this experience as Maslow described it, a peak experience. One that brought you deep satisfaction in your well-being, one you were likely never to forget. The final team talk, led by G, afforded us a congratulatory talk, keeping you on a high sufficiently long enough to complete the questionnaire for favourable feedback. Our final task was to collect our photographs, and we were advised to buy them in a group of four, which allowed a cheaper price to be achieved. Around $32 allowed us to download all the photographs and videos, if you did one, to our phones. These we could share instantly with our families, waiting anxiously for word that we'd completed the climb of a lifetime safely. And we did. Go us.